Rewind, your week in review is sponsored by the Wisconsin Realtors Association, bringing Wisconsin communities to life with great homes, businesses, and neighborhoods. The Wisconsin Realtors Association, the voice of real estate.
This program is brought to you from the Margaret Farrow Studio.
This week on Rewind, your week in review, a landslide victory for Supreme Court Justice-elect Chris Taylor. Plus, Universities of Wisconsin President Jay Rothman is fired. And Governor Tony Evers signs a law that opens the door to online sports betting in Wisconsin. All that and more on Rewind, your week in review for April 10th. I'm Ani Van Wagtendonk.
And I'm J.R. Ross.
Welcome to Rewind. We had a crazy week this week. I found myself asking what day it was several times this week. So let's go back in time all the way to Tuesday, election night, where we saw the largest landslide victory, certainly that I have seen in the state of Wisconsin, the largest judicial one in decades. This is, of course, Chris Taylor beating Maria Lazar by 20 points. And so first we will throw to some video. We will look at their two respective speeches, and then we will talk about what made this race so different from other races.
I don't think that I've run this race for no purpose. I think that this race was run so that people in this state from now on will know that judicial races are not political races. And the next race, and the next race, and the next race, we will keep fighting to put judges, good, talented judges with experience on the bench. And I want everyone to know that your votes were not cast in vain, and that you did set a mark and draw a line and say, Wisconsin deserves better. And I'm hopeful in future years that will happen.
Tonight, we stand strongly for a state Supreme Court that prioritizes the people of Wisconsin, their rights, their lives, and the independence of our great state, and for a court that holds everyone accountable under the law, no matter how powerful or privileged. I will be a justice for you, the people of Wisconsin. Thank you, Wisconsin. Forward we go, together.
So there's a lot to discuss here. Again, huge landslide. But going into it, right, we talked a lot about how spending was way down from previous races. And so there was a little bit of this question of, like, what will the actual kind of outcome be of reduced spending, reduced energy, reduced stakes on both sides? And part of what we've seen is that it resulted in this incredibly lopsided victory, and also some really interesting county-by-county results. So kind of talk us through the spending and those outcomes.
Let's start big picture first. So let's pump the brakes. I see a lot of national conversation about, oh, Wisconsin, 20-point victory. What's this mean for November? Not much. If you go back historically, 2008, Michael Gableman won by 2 points in Wisconsin's Supreme Court race in April. Barack Obama won by 14 points in November. 2016, Rebecca Braley won by almost 5 points in the Supreme Court race in April. Donald Trump won by less than 1 point. You know, you just kind of go down. Jill Karofsky in 2020 won in the spring by 10. Joe Biden less than one. I mean, you just go through like all these years. 2018.
Yeah.
Dowd won by 10 points. Tony Evers 1.1. So all the examples where the electorate is just different. And the second thing is the spending was so disparate. Now, going into Tuesday, I counted up what was reported by the two candidates through their finance reports, what we had from independent expenditure reports, and then also from Ad Impact, which is a tracking service for ads, about an 8-to-1 advantage for Chris Taylor. So you are not going to see, barring some miraculous events this fall, an 8-to-1 spending advantage in the governor's race, okay? But if you add up an electorate that is trending Democratic in spring elections, you add in an environment where Donald Trump numbers are decreasing by the day, you have Iran going on, gas prices going up, Trump voters in general disengaged from spring races anyway, and you have the spending on top of that, that's how you get a 20-point blowout. The largest one I've seen actually happened right before I got here in 2000. Then Justice Diane Seitz got 65.5%. Back then, incumbents almost never lost, and it was all about experience, judicial or law enforcement endorsements, and how much resources you had. We live in an environment now where the race is about where do you stand the position on the issues. And Chris Taylor engaged people on that topic. Lazar did not. That's how you get this kind of a race.
Right. It was so interesting looking at their kind of respective speeches. And in the video that we just saw, Lazar talking about, I really think that we sent a message mm-hmm. that people want experienced judges and that they are not interested in, you know, like activists in these issues. But actually what we are seeing in terms of voter turnout and polling, the Marquette polling shows that increasingly mm-hmm. voters kind of across the board want judges who reflect their values on these kinds of issues. And so we see that kind of in how these races are won. We also saw that with Dan Kelly, who also, you know, declined to be sort of part of a more politicized process. He declined to take money from the Republican Party. That did not go well for him.
Schimmel, though, and I've seen some Republicans say, we've got to do this differently. We can't, like, stop doing this judicial race. We have to be a political race. Brad Schimmel embraced Donald Trump, embraced Elon Musk. It's not like he was non-political. Yeah, I get Lazar was trying to say, I'm not a conservative, and Daniel Kelly with the whole, I'm not taking money from the party, but I'll take in-kind contributions from the party. But they've tried everything. They've tried to spend as much, if not more. They've tried to go political. It's just not working in the spring. You see it county by county. So, yeah, you know, the wild counties are cratering for Republicans. And again, this environment, the spending, everything else makes it a little bit more skewed. But Taylor won Ozaukee County by 8 points. Like, you can't ignore that. She won Vilas County, for crying out loud. I mean, we're talking, like, deep red up north. But what happened, if you go through that impact and look at, like, the Wausau-Rhinelander media market, there was spending by one candidate, not by the other. Conservative voters around Wisconsin weren't told who the conservative was because nobody's communicating who their candidate was. That's what gets you blowouts in these weird counties where you go, not the counties themselves are weird, love Vilas County, but you get these weird results of, like, how does that happen? Well, if you don't know who to vote for, not reaching out to you, you stay home, and that's what happens.
Right. This is sort of a frustrating, I think, read from a lot of national media was, oh, my gosh, Chris Taylor has won Trump country, right? Like, what does this portend for November? Well, what that portends is that liberal voters come out in the spring, and we have known this for several years now. The Republican Party in their postmortem last year came up with the same read, which is that the demographics of who comes out in the spring is different than who comes out in November. So it's not that Chris Taylor won over Trump voters. It's that Trump voters stayed home this time around.
2018, so the Timmy Baldwin in 2026, like I saw these national, or 24, sorry, all these national media of, oh, you know, she wins in Trump country. It's like, well, yeah, in 2018, Leah Vukmir had no money to run ads in Wausau. If you can't run ads in Wausau, Baldwin's going to do well in that market, right? She didn't, like, win the entire 7th Congressional, but she did well up there. I wasn't surprised by the narrow margin in 2024 with Baldwin because that's what Wisconsin is like a lot of times, right? But, so the national media, no offense, guys, we love you, but stop reading too much into Wisconsin, okay? It's kind of not an aberration, but it is not the same as November electorate.
But let's read a little bit too much into the Wow counties really quickly. So you mentioned that Taylor won Ozaukee, which is really interesting. And then also Maria Lazar, comparing, let's say, Rebecca Bradley and Maria Lazar, her margins, Lazar's margins, were much, much lower in these, you know, reliably conservative Wow counties. And then two, Chris Taylor did exceptionally well in her home county of Dane County, 82%, right? Compared to Maria Lazar in her home county of Waukesha, 54%. So what does that tell you?
Look, if you at home want to, like, be really smart on election nights in Wisconsin, pull up the Waukesha County Clerk's website and the Dane County Clerk's website about 8:45 on election night. Check the Waukesha County Clerk's website first. They're very good at posting things very quick. If you are a conservative candidate and you're below 62.5%, which is what Ron Johnson got in 2022, you are in trouble, right? Now, that's end of the night. Even at 8:45, 9 o'clock, if you're below that, not a great sign. The exception is Donald Trump. He won in 16 and 24 below 60% because he did well outstate. He also got into Dane County, which is your second check. Dane County, just a touch slower, but still pretty good. Check about 9 o'clock. If you're seeing the Democrat above 80% on that website and the Republican over here below 60%, the race is over. Like, barring turnout in northern Wisconsin, unlike anything we've ever seen, because remember, even Trump didn't just win because of northern Wisconsin 24. He kept Harris below 80% in Dane County. There's your math anymore. When I was a young man, much younger, math is all about Milwaukee. Like, you hit a certain number of Milwaukee, you were golden. It's all changed. It's all about Waukesha County as a gauge for Republicans to see where they're at. Dane County is the blue powerhouse for Democrats. And then do you see any signs in northern Wisconsin of like a real uptick in enthusiasm? We saw the blue powerhouse, not good here for Republicans, not good at all here for Republicans. That's what you got what happened.
And then there were, of course, some other elections that happened on Tuesday. It wasn't just a Supreme Court race. And so we picked out a couple that were interesting. Again, speaking of Waukesha, the mayor's race, and one great thing about elections is that we have a bunch of new names that we have to learn how to pronounce, so I hope I'm getting this right. Halvin Slabin beat Representative Scott Allen. So a Democrat will be mayor of Waukesha. That was a pretty significant win. What does that tell you?
We'll talk a little bit more later in the show, but it tells me that there's a lot of stuff going on in Waukesha. And it could be part of it is it's not your grandfather's Waukesha, right? Like, is it all everything, demographics, money, resources, all going to that race?
And so then also the La Crosse County Board Representative Steve Doyle, who typically wins his assembly races by like 11 votes. He won quite handily by a couple of hundred. And then the River Falls mayor race. Why did that one jump out to you?
So River Falls, this is a sign of how bad things were for conservatives on Tuesday. Now, they won in some spots, like I think Oconomowoc. They still elected a conservative mayor in like red Waukesha County. But here you have Allison Page, who ran at least two or three times for the legislature, lost every time. She will beat an incumbent mayor by double digits. Now, again, a couple things going on, depressed turnout on the conservative side, resource advantage on the liberal side, but you're also seeing some changes. You know, maybe you're seeing River Falls start to kind of change a little bit. Something to keep an eye on, because she didn't win by like a little bit. She won by 10 points. That's kind of crazy. Now with Doyle, look, it's been kind of interesting to watch. There are a number of lawmakers who have local offices as well being in the state legislature. If you lose your local office, not a great sign for how things went back home. But Doyle here won like basically 2-1. Again, not huge turnout, county board seat. But if you're looking for signs of Doyle being in trouble this fall, you're not seeing it, what happened there in this county board race.
And then the other really interesting thing that has gotten some national attention as well, and we'll talk about it a little bit more during the stock report, but Port Washington approved the nation's first anti-data center referendum. So this essentially says that the community gets more say in any type of data center project, where they would have to approve any deal worth $10 million or more, and this comes after a multi-billion dollar deal within that community. So we saw a lot of kind of pushback, both in terms of candidates who were being supported and this referendum. What does that tell you about how data centers are playing into the election?
It tells me that people are afraid. They're afraid of like their power bills going up. They're afraid of AI in general and change. I mean, all these things are kind of combining to be like, and environmental concerns. What is going on in my backyard kind of thing?
Yeah, and so again, we'll get into that more, but it is interesting to see how polling is increasingly showing that voters see the costs outweighing the benefits, both Republican and Democratic voters. So very interesting. Also on Tuesday, the UW president, Jay Rothman, was fired. We talked about this kind of what seemed like a sudden tension between him and the Board of Regents that came out through these letters that were published last week. So they held a meeting on Tuesday. He was unanimously fired. Republicans were not happy about this, and so they then held a Senate committee hearing to discuss the Evers nominees to the Board of Regents. Going into it, I think a lot of us questioned whether they were going to then reject all of these Evers nominees, whether there would kind of be a mass firing. It's not exactly what happened, so let's look at a little bit of video from that committee hearing.
I would argue going back quite a few years, the Regents have been viewed as the gatekeepers for the status quo. So if you're telling me there's a new revelation within the Board of Regents that says the president isn't acting quick enough in terms of significant reforms and efficiencies, that is A, surprising, B, encouraging, and would love to hear a little bit more context as to how that is the new face of the Regents.
I always sensed a lack of urgency on some of these issues, which to me look like they're pressing on these universities today. And an answer a year from now or 2 years from now is not going to be good enough.
And I think right now we're kind of at a precipice in higher education. You mentioned the demographic slide, and the pressures are coming down hard on us. This narrative that higher education isn't necessary, it is part of this decision is that we need a transformative leader and that we have to really take us into the future, which is, to me, yesterday.
Right, so that exchange was about sort of the Regents making a little bit more public what some of their concerns were about Jay Rothman. They said that he had a very top-down leadership style, that he was kind of slow to embrace change. What did you make of that exchange?
The regents could have like done themselves some favors. They put that out there ahead of time. So look, we kind of got wind of this last week with these letters from Rothman, released by the university, saying he had been given this choice: fire or resign or be fired. And you've given me no indication why. Okay, how's that work? Like, you got no heads up whatsoever. Nobody ever said, hey, you're unhappy about anything? That's kind of odd. And then as we got toward Tuesday, Republicans started coming out with statements like, this is a hatchet job, this is partisan, this is because he wants to work with us and not just be Democrat, essentially, or whatever. There's the hearing. And again, during the whole thing on Tuesday, nothing except like, we got a problem here. Well, then he starts saying he's a little bit heavy-handed top-down. We got too many bureaucrats. We're questioning, like, how many administrators do we have? Should we have this many administrators? Why are they all there? And he's not really reacting. We are in a time of change in higher education where AI is a thing and we're slow to move. We have to be more flexible. That got public attention to like, oh, okay, now we're hearing some things. And they were originally going to have a public hearing and then exec right afterward and basically vote on each of these 10. The Senate has confirmation powers over it. Now they've adjourned for the session, so would they really come back just to vote these guys down? But they did have the power to do that. You know, they'd taken the votes on the committee, been symbolic at least, of we're not happy, here's a message. We may come back in at some point before January 4th, whatever it is, and vote them down because we can. But then they backed off. We're going to get more information. Hutton says he's asking for more about these handwritten notes from the regent's chair, president, to find out what's going on. But the bottom line is Rothman is an at-will employee of the university, the board. They have this power. They could have done a better job explaining why they were doing what they were doing, but they had the power to do it. Now, Rothman's gone on like up front and taped an interview saying, I'm not going to challenge my termination. We've seen some other kind of details pop out where a former UW administrator got a hold of an email he sent to the members of the board and Rothman saying, hey, you told me a couple years ago, either you resign or I'm going to fire you, essentially, or basically you're being pushed out. I'm not going to tell you why. Didn't give me any kind of like indication I'd done a bad job. So you're basically a hypocrite for making this kind of like, in his words, belly aching about what's going on. Now, the questions going forward are, okay, who's going to be next? Who are they going to get to as lead this university system going forward? Now, politics plays a small role in higher education sometimes. And you have a board that's all Evers appointees. So there are 18 members. Two of them are like Jill Underley, the state superintendent and the president of the Tech College Board. They get their ex officio members, we call them officially. Other 16 are all Evers appointees. 10 aren't confirmed. So fast forward to January, the next governor, in theory, could wipe out the 10 who aren't confirmed and start fresh. So if a Tom Tiffany were to win, it'd be a whole different ball game for that board. You have a president who got fired. So are you cautious about taking the job because of this guy getting fired? Who's the governor going to be? Who's going to make sure the legislature? So I'm wondering if this process is going to take a while. Remember, they had a search 6-7 years ago, and it failed. The guy that they had picked to lead said, I changed my mind, I'm not going to do this. And so they brought back Tommy Thompson. He was an interim leader, got lots of kind of good marks for his time there, especially during COVID. So how's this going to look going forward, what they're going to do? And again, who's going to want this job, and what's the environment look like for him or her when they take it?
And a couple of things that we're also looking out for. Republicans said that they've filed an open records request to get a sense of his performance review. So that might reveal some of the, again, the reasoning why the president of the Regents Board said that if Rothman chooses to waive confidentiality, she could share more. In the meantime, he will continue collecting his salary through October. And so you could also see a kind of situation like what we see with Bucks coaches, where you're kind of double dipping, and that creates its own set of challenges. Also this week, Evers signed some bills, vetoed some bills, partially vetoed one significant bill. So some of the ones that we were looking at, online gaming, and we'll get a little bit deeper into that, but that has been signed. So that opens the door to potentially having online sports betting in the future, and we'll talk about what that means. And then the other kind of big one that we were looking at, name, image, likeness, that is essentially all but signed, but he partially vetoed some of the language around how the money can be spent by the UW system. He said that that would kind of open up more flexibility. And then two big vetoes, one on food share, data sharing. We knew that this veto was coming because he's in active litigation against the Trump mandate to to require people who receive food assistance to share certain data about them. And then he also vetoed sort of Republican-led changes to election law. So, again, aside from gaming, which we're about to jump into, what kind of jumps out at you from that?
No real surprises in anything like the election laws. He's been pretty steadfast. I'm not going to sign those kinds of things. The food stamp stuff, I mean, the election changes included trying to get the Elections Commission, Department of Transportation, other agencies to share information and then check the rolls for people who aren't there, who are no longer eligible, then to remove them from the rolls. So remember, in Wisconsin, our system is you're on the roll, you're either active or inactive. So if I become, let's say I commit a felon this weekend, felony this weekend, get convicted.
Don't do it, JR.
I'll try my best. I become inactive till my service, my probation, everything is done, right? My time in jail. So then I become active again after I re-register. But when I'm inactive, I'm not in the poll book going to the poll workers on election day. Republicans want you to be removed totally. They think there's an option for fraud there. Democrats are saying that's not true. So yeah, no real surprise in what they did, what the governor did with these bills.
One slight surprise was the sort of statement that he released with the online gaming bill. So he signed it, but there was kind of this open question forever. He signed it on the day of the deadline. And so the question was, you know, it had support from some of the tribes, but not all of the tribes. And he kept saying, I will kind of do what the tribes want. And then you guys reported that all 11 tribes submitted a quite short letter this week just saying, we support this. This has bipartisan support. And so based on that, Evers then released this letter saying, I defer to the sovereignty of the tribes, and because they have asked for this, I will defer to that, but I have concerns. He said, this legislation is the beginning of a conversation, not the end of one. The real work begins today. Each of the tribes must now work together to shape the future of sports betting in Wisconsin. What I will not accept is a plan that fractures this opportunity into unequal pieces, allowing some tribes to reap great benefits while leaving only crumbs for others. So that's one big part of the sort of political pie here, is how the different tribes felt about it, right? Potawatomi and Ho-Chunk, who have big gaming operations, who have some of the infrastructure already, versus some of the other tribes that don't have that. So talk first about the tribal politics of it, and then we can also talk about the potential lawsuits that might be coming.
Yeah, interesting. The Oneida were a holdout. So like, they're one of the other big tribes. They have one of the bigger reservations up in the Green Bay area. I believe they have online gaming actually on the reservation, so you can't do it off-site, but on it. I think that's true. But anyway, why? We couldn't even answer out of the other three, like, why you're not on the first letter we got mid-March saying, please pass this bill. But there is definitely disparity in how well these tribes are all doing. Yes, they all have the access to gaming, but you can drive by the Potawatomi Casino in downtown Milwaukee and go up north and see the smaller ones, like in Wittenberg, and go, wow, there's a bit of a difference in like what's going on here, because the Potawatomi have land in the biggest population center in Wisconsin. Up north, you don't. You don't have people in Chicago driving past your casino on the way to vacation up north, right? From a lot of them. So anyway, Evers seems to be kind of hinting at, like, I want equal treatment, equal opportunity. How's that going to look? How's that work? As you put it very well, this opens the door to potentially having online gaming. So next steps are the governor has to rip the compacts, there are 11 of them, and negotiate new deals. Then, once they reach an agreement, they go to the Bureau of Indian Affairs to have them be signed off by the feds. Then we could have online gaming in Wisconsin off reservation. What's that system look like the governor's talking about? There's no details. The tribes haven't really said anything about what this could be. So I'm really kind of curious, what are you going to negotiate that's fair, quote unquote, to everybody? And I use fair in air quotes, because how do you define fair? Like, if you're a bigger tribe and you have more of an operation, do you get the same cut of online gaming as like the smallest tribe? I really don't know.
And, you know, there are some other states that have models in place. Florida is kind of the basis for the hub-and-spoke model that they're describing here. And so maybe they'll be looking towards those other models. Reportedly, the tribes are kind of already in conversation, so we will see that. And then the other thing I'm looking out for is that Will has been really opposed to this on sort of constitutional, state and federal constitutional grounds. So they say it essentially, A, that the legislature has no business kind of regulating gaming, period, so they can't change the law as it relates to gaming, and that this creates sort of like an unfair race-based monopoly over gaming. And so I'm also waiting to see if they're going to file suit and then what that does to this whole process.
And that part about the race-based gaming, look, I'm not a lawyer, as I often say, but we opened the door to gaming on reservations in the 80s when we approved a lottery. The U.S. Supreme Court then ruled if you allow a lottery, you must allow tribes or sovereign nations to allow gaming. That opened the compacts you've had since late 80s, early 90s. that to me suggests you have to have a U.S. Supreme Court decision to overturn that precedent from way back when. That's going to take a while if that's going to happen.
So, again, a very kind of interesting situation unfolding, and perhaps for a while. That takes us to the stock report. It gives you another chance to pronounce Alicia Halvinslaven, the new Democratic mayor of Waukesha.
So, look, this is a blue beachhead in red Waukesha County. It's not unprecedented, though. Larry Nelson, who used to wear flip-flops to work once in a while, I think, was mayor of Waukesha.
Fun fact.
2006 Democratic wave. He won, got lost in 2010 as things snapped back against Democrats. But so, okay. We've seen that before. It's still Waukesha. Donald Trump, I went back and looked at the city returns. He won it 52% of the vote in Waukesha, the city of Waukesha, in 2024. Susan Crawford narrowly beat Brad Schimmel in Waukesha, the city of Waukesha, in 2025. In 2026, however, Chris Taylor, I don't say really beat her badly, but did a pretty good job for a liberal in Waukesha. She beat Marie Lazar about 1,500 votes plus. So that's one thing that happened, all right? Top of the ticket really helped Alicia win this race over Scott Allen, a state lawmaker. The second thing that happened was outside groups spent $240,000 on independent expenditures, like turning people out in her favor. So you have the drag at the top of the ticket. You have outside help, and Allen got none that I saw for independent expenditure reports. That's going to help. Now, my questions are, will she be a one-hit wonder like Larry Nelson? That's one term and you're done. Is her staying power? How will she govern as mayor? Like, what's this going to look like? But you can't ignore the bigger symbolism of there's a problem in the suburbs for Republicans. You go through, we talked about wild counties, you go right through them and how they've changed in a 10-year period. What's been happening over that 10-year period? Donald Trump. Like, he is driving this. And so when you talk about the Supreme Court race and what happened, yeah, give Chris Taylor credit. She ran a good campaign. She had a good message, connected to voters. Knock Marie Lazar. She wasn't a great candidate in the fact that she doubled down on abortion in an odd way, talking about, like, she supports a 20-week compromise, which didn't really make abortion rights advocates happy and also made anti-abortion activists unhappy. Kind of a weird approach. Didn't have any money. The coalition abandoned her. All kinds of things going on. But there is an issue for conservatives in spring races, and they've got a problem in their hands. Here's an example of, like, what are you going to do about it? How are you going to fix this? The coalition sat this one out, and that was a big problem for them, and you get it. This is an example of the win that you get when you do that kind of thing.
The other kind of big thing that was on the ballot is school referendums. Per usual, dozens of school referendums on the ballot this cycle.
So more got approved than rejected. What's interesting is the Wisconsin Policy Forum has done studies on this for years and looked at, in midterms of presidential elections, he's trying to see a higher approval rate of referendums than in off-year elections. We are off to a bad start of keeping that going after what happened on Now, more approved than disapproved. There's like a little more than a billion on the ballot, like 560 million just got approved, so like still a healthy chunk. But we saw 80% plus approved if you go back 24, 22, 20, 18, big numbers. Now, 24 is 70%. So what I'm wondering is, when you take 2026 all together, where are we going to be? Because this might reflect the Marquette poll, which we saw a month ago, again showing this trend of people being more concerned about property taxes than school funding, and also they were going to vote against referendum. Now, that pool of voters they surveyed in March, more Republican than who turned out, obviously, in April. But it tells you the problem that schools have in going to referendum, where people are kind of more like, I'm not so happy about this anymore. This is getting expensive, especially at the poll, and it shows that people are worried about affordability. That's not helping their case when that's a top issue for voters.
And then also, speaking of affordability, falling is data centers. We saw that referendum.
So Port Washington did the referendum. Janesville is going to have a referendum this fall. A member of the city council got booted on Tuesday after the council had signed this, like, deal about a data center kind of thing or approaching one. And there's polling out this week from a group saying voters are unhappy about data centers, right? They're worried about all these issues about the environment, about AI, et cetera, et cetera. So my question is, politically, if you're running for governor, how do you get out ahead of the data center issue? Like, what's your approach going to be? Like a Francesca Hong, for example, she's pretty consistent saying, like, I've got problems with these things. But when they first came on the scene, there were these big, giant investments that would create jobs, construction jobs at front end. Port Washington's tax base is going to be thrive because of this. Now you're getting like the, wait a second, how much water are you going to use? It's going to impact my utility bill. We're seeing utilities and the data center folks trying to assure people you're not going to be impacted. They're going to cover all the costs. I don't think people believe them about that. So I'm wondering is, if you're in the primary for governor, especially on the Democratic side, how do you work this issue? What is your path going to be? Because if you get elected and you're anti-data center, can you work with them afterward? What's Tom Tiffany going to do? You know, because this is not a Democratic issue alone. There are Republicans who are also unhappy about this as well. The polling we saw this week, Republicans are more likely to be okay with data centers than Democrats, but not by a huge margin. So yeah, this is going to be a potent issue this fall, especially combined with your utility bill. We just saw We Energy is asking for another boost, 8%, whatever it was, of next year. People started to go, hey, wait a second here, this is getting expensive. What's going on, man?
Yeah, we saw them not be able to reach consensus in the legislature, and so this is going to be, I think, one of the defining issues of the election. So it'll be really interesting to watch. But that'll do it for us on Rewind this week. I am Uneven Wagton Talk.
And I'm J.R. Ross.
See you next week.
This program was brought to you from the Margaret Farrow Studio.
Rewind, your week in review, is sponsored by the Wisconsin Realtors Association, bringing Wisconsin communities to life with great homes, businesses, and neighborhoods. The Wisconsin Realtors Association, the voice of real estate.